All right.
We're ready.
Don't know that I can do the whole Steph whoop whoop thing, so we'll just let that live with her.
Wait, okay. I was just making sure mine worked.
Really close, like
she
this.
Said, yeah, she said to eat it.
Oh, that's, I don't know that I can do that. I'm more of a ambient, just kind of keep it close.
Virtual people?
Okay, virtual people will thank me. So virtual people, you're welcome. In person, I'm sorry. So we'll go from there. All right, are we good to go? Ready to rock and roll? Welcome to Marketing Your Niche. So this is obviously you have picked a niche. You are defined on your niche. Now it is all about how do I promote and position myself into this field that I have defined. If you are not in that session or if you don't feel like that is you, I will give you the opportunity to exit stage left and go into the main ballroom because Steph and Tiff are talking about defining your niche. So if you find yourself on the wrong side of that coin, go ahead. You won't hurt Lauren and my feelings doing that. So let's go ahead and dive right in.
Okay. That's me. First.
Oh, we've got it there, too. I forgot
yeah, we
about
do.
That.
I yes, have to wear yes. my glasses, though, so I can see it. First, I'd love if anyone's willing to share what their niche is with the group.
Yes, let's make this a dialogue more than just a monologue. And virtual people, we will narrate, if you will, what we have.
Yes.
Go ahead, Danelle.
Dan-
we will be judge and jury
Danelle's
as to whether you get chips.
Only sharing if she gets chips. Okay, you'll get a chip. Okay, founders position for an exit in a couple of years. Who else? Chris, I saw your hand. Oh, sorry, there's two Chris's. Oops, that's awkward. Gen X, Gen Y business owner, Sean. And you've gone, I know there was a little debate. Okay, he's in, commercial real estate executives.
Michelle?
Employees at Lubrizol,
yes.
Within 2 years of retirement.
Within 2 years of retirement with at least $1 million of investable assets. That's the best niche so far.
Okay, Sarah, last one. Real estate professionals, ideally women-led with children. Awesome. Well, so kind of the bad news is none of this will happen overnight, as you can see on the slide. It does take time to, as you all know, fully establish your niche and then define your marketing plan for them. So we break it down, and we're going to talk through all of this into three different phases. There's the established phase, which, congratulations, you've all done. So you're already ahead of the Armstrong room. Don't tell them I said that. And then the elevate and then enhance phase. So we'll walk you through all of that.
Make sure that's this is making sure that your phone is on silent because the last thing that I want is that going off. So my apologies. Here's what I would say respectfully pushing back. Well, I say respectfully pushing back. We created these slides. So I want to put an asterisk next to that, the whole three-year plan. Does it take 3 years? Yes and no. It can take 3 years, but I, along with many other advisors, have seen it happen faster than that. What I would say, and this is why I called out Michelle and said that I liked her niche the best, I find that there is a direct correlation to the more specific your niche is, the faster you can accelerate your presence and your expertise in that niche, because not to use or the best metaphor that I can think of to this is you're using a rifle instead of a shotgun. The more targeted you can be in your approach and your messaging, you are screaming with a bullhorn to the 0.01% of the audience that needs to hear you, and also disassociating yourself with 99.93% or whatever the other aspect of that ratio that I used. The narrower you take your niche, the narrower that ICA, that ideal client avatar, is, the easier and faster you can accelerate that messaging. And there's all kinds of different ways to market to your niche, right? There's the referrals, the COIs, as Michelle, the professional aspect, right? When you're working with a specific industry or a specific with a specific company, all of the ways in which you're defining your niche are going to influence how you market to that niche. I personally find that the easiest niche to market to are those that are based off of a profession or a specific company. And everything that I heard in here was basically built towards a profession or a company. The different approach to niche marketing is when you're talking about passion prospecting, to use Ron Carson's his example that I learned way back. If anybody here has read Test in the Trenches, right? Ron, at the time that he wrote that book, loved two things, wine and aviation. We are kindred spirits, right? But the challenge from that marketing standpoint is the front end marketing becomes much easier because you're aligning passion with prospecting. You're sharing similar interests, etc. The downside to that from a service and an efficiency standpoint is when you think about Stephanie and what we've talked about here at Limitless, this wedding cake service model. If you're passion prospecting, you can find yourself with a master of ones. You have one business owner, like if I were to build a practice around flying, I might have 10 different clients that are in 10 different professions. One of them might have had an IPO, the other might be a commercial real estate investor, the other might be a highly successful physician, the other one might have liquidated their Lubrizol 401k because they'd really wanted to buy an airplane. All kinds of different challenges from a planning perspective. But you don't have to do all kinds of different things to market to these individuals. You can pick one or two or three channels. Podcasting for me has been the single best flywheel to get going that then feeds all kinds of different opportunities.
Quick shout out to Michelle. I snapped one of your LinkedIns because I've been so proud of you, because that was a goal of yours to be on LinkedIn more. But also, you know, I think it really speaks to your niche and you're being very targeted about it.
The Captain Obvious of what we're showing up here is the more specialized you are. Again, I've kind of said this already, but the type of content that you create, this is why, regardless of what type of question an advisor brings to me in Limitless, very, very early on, if it's not the first question, it is one of the first two or three questions. What is your niche? And marketing is not immune to that. The conversation I was having with Lyle, I think Lyle's in the other room right now, as someone that is in the infancy stages of developing his niche, I just told him, and I'll tell everybody here, the easier and the narrower you take that message, the more narrower you take your niche, your ideal client avatar, the easier everything else becomes, including your messaging. The hardest part that advisors struggle with is we have been yes people our entire lives. We have been, if it fogs a mirror, right, then they should be a client, or they could be a potential client. And the hardest thing for me to get comfortable with as an advisor, until I essentially burned the ships and went to the dark side, right, is being comfortable saying no and not being in a position to say, yes, I can help you. Can I help you? Sure. Am I the best person to help you? No. And when you can get comfortable saying no and then realizing in that same breath that, oh, there actually might be another advisor out there that's better suited to help this person. If a teacher came to me, could I help them because they saw, because if I did a Shred event, right, and a teacher was one of the people that was at that event and they're wanting to retire from their school district and they've got their 401(b) or 403(b) and their VEBA and their TSP and everything that comes with that, could I help them? Possibly. Am I the best person to help them? No. A, it's a horrible return on time for me, because I have to spend God knows how much time trying to learn the Thrift Savings Plan, or not TSP, in Indiana, INPERS, the Indiana Public Retirement System. I have to learn INPERS and how the 403(b) works, and God help me, I've actually helped people get money out of VALIC, so let's not even talk about that nightmare. Like, I don't want to do that, but I know there are other advisors that are better suited to help them, so it saves me time, because now that opportunity cost of me saying no to that person means that I can invest the time into my ideal niche by doing activities that are going to attract my ideal client, and I'm helping that person get a better client experience to what Julie was talking about. Could I deliver a good experience? Yes. Is someone else more qualified to deliver a great experience and do the right thing the first time? Absolutely. It's getting to that point that is what I have observed being one of the harder things for advisors to uh, to reconcile.
Yeah, just to chime in really quickly, whenever, you know, before I have my meetings with you all, I go look at all your websites, and if I cannot identify within 5 seconds who you work with, I make a note of it and probably tell you. I should not have to wonder, like, do you work with me or do you work with my parents? So just keep that in mind for your websites.
Yeah, and on that note to the website, when you do define your niche, that doesn't mean that your bounce rate is something that you can just say, oh, you know, my bounce rate is 90%. That must be because I'm repelling everybody that comes to my website. The challenge now is, all right, who is coming to your website? How are they getting there? If they are the right person, why are they leaving? So again, not to digress down that other path, but as you get more refined in your niche and you start evaluating the impact of the marketing activities that you're taking in your business, you now start thinking about and seeing the decisions that you make a little bit differently, right? You're now 2 to 3 layers deep when you're looking at the number of people that are coming to my website. How many people have visited my website in the last 30 days? How did they get there? Oh, interestingly enough, they're coming from LinkedIn, from the posts that I'm putting on LinkedIn, but they're leaving right away. All right, well, the content that I'm putting on LinkedIn is very targeted, so I'm going to assume that they are either optometrists, ophthalmologists, or whatever that might be. Why are they leaving? So again, you start asking yourself different questions and better questions as you get more refined through this process.
Yeah, so moral of the story, don't overcomplicate it. You know, I think upon talking to a lot of y'all, you'll tell me, oh, I'm going to do a podcast, and I'm going to do a blog and a newsletter and my referral strategy. And it's like,
and,
okay.
And.
Yeah, and pick, you know, 2 or 3 things that you feel like really speak to your personality. If you don't like doing videos, probably don't become a YouTube star like Patrick back there, you know? And so... yeah, just, you know, find what works for you and also for your niche.
And don't, like, I had one more point that I was going to make on that.
It was going to be a good one.
It was going to be a good one, not to leave you on a cliffhanger there, but maybe it'll come back to me. Talked about this a little bit, right? If I visit your website and I can't tell who you do your best work for and why I should work with you in the first 10 seconds, right, that hero space on a website, that could be, should be one of your first projects from a just promoting and positioning going forward. If you've identified your niche, that's awesome. If we're talking about promoting and positioning yourself to your niche, your business card, your digital landscape, your digital storefront, Kitsis talks about this all the time, about how much you would pay to have someone walk into your office for the opportunity to convert them into somebody that might do business with you, right? I've always thought of people in 3 different camps. Like, your ideal prospects are in 3 different camps. They're your right-aways, your some-days, and your no-ways, right? The no-ways, those are the easy people. Those might be your do-it-yourselfer, and that might, as this whole one-to-many advice community, or this whole one-to-many community-based approach to dispensing financial information and creating a cohort around your niche, something that we're working on. We're probably in the 7th inning of development right now, is the 2020 Money Membership. So every OD that comes to our website that doesn't fit our ideal client avatar, they're not at the point in their practice, but we want to nurture them for the opportunity to potentially up-level to a client. I don't want to just send them out. I want to have some type of in-between spot for them to go. So I want to make sure that my website promotes and positions this idea of, hey, you're either an ideal client or potentially an ideal client, or if you're not, if your practice isn't doing at least $800,000 in revenue, you haven't owned it for at least 2 years, then maybe you might want to check out the 2020 Money Membership. So whether you're thinking about refining down into multiple different service models or creating a standalone media brand that would be around your niche can be the hub of your practice. And then think about these different spokes that can come up. To Lauren's point before, that is an and, but it might not be, it very well shouldn't be, the first decision that you're making. As you're going through this process, don't, like, that is a next, that's kind of a chapter 2, chapter 3 of your niche. Build the brand, build the credibility, build your following, and then have options down the road. Just don't get sucked into that build mode over and over and over again before you have essentially proof of concept and traction.
Yeah, so when we say know your numbers, I think there's 2 things that are, you know, kind of important here. The first is being just really knowing, you know, filling out that model practice sheet that all of you have supposed to have done by now. And really knowing, like, where are you trying to go? Okay, if I want to grow to X size and have this many clients, I need, you know, to bring on let's say 10 this year. I think there's something powerful in knowing I want to bring on 10 clients this year versus I want to onboard clients this year, you know, and getting really specific about what your goals are. And then also knowing, you know, how big is the market that you're marketing to. So Michelle, to pick on you, like how many Lubrizol employees could you, are your ideal clients?
There's 4,300 in Northeastern Ohio.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the point is, Michelle knows that, you know, how many are out there for her. And I know I wish Don was here because he usually does this session and has better intel on this. I don't know if you want to share about.
Well, so I'll use the analogy that I talk about all the time, or I'll share the same story that I talk about on the podcast all the time with optometric practice owners, because I talk all the time about being intentional, building an intentional practice, planning life on purpose. It's the tagline to our firm and the planning process that we engage with them in. A times B times C. For practice owners, it's average revenue per patient, revenue per comp exam, number of patients they can see per day, doctor days per week. If they have three doctors in the practice, each of them working 4 days per week, great, that's 12 doctor days per week. A times B times C gives them top line revenue. Average doctor time in a comprehensive optometric exam is 30 minutes. So that's the, like, I can do the math with them on the back of a cocktail napkin or the dry erase board in about 15 minutes and put together a comprehensive business plan for them. The same metaphor, or the same analogy is true for us. And when we talk about the fee schedule here, I believe that's tomorrow, when we're doing fee schedules, if you're interested in that, we're going to go through a whole exercise that talks about how to calculate what your top line revenue needs to be based off of what your operating expenses are and how much you want to make personally. You have to do that math when you're picking your niche. And again, if you're in here, we are going to assume, hopefully, you've done the math on what the average revenue per client is going to be and how many hours it's going to take you to serve those clients. For our onboarding process, it is up to four meetings plus the go meeting and then follow up from that. So John has roughly 12 hours of invested time per new client. I have 45 minutes of my time in the discovery call and the triage call, et cetera, that we do, or that's all one call. So we've done that HR calculation. We know how many clients we can bring on. We know what John's capacity is, and we know what our revenue per client is going to be. As you're doing your, if you're like, do that exercise for your niche, because that is going to be the ultimate glass ceiling that you're going to rise up against. And if you don't like any of those variables, guess what? We have the option to change those variables. If I don't want to spend 12 hours and I want to reduce that amount of time that I'm spending with my clients, okay, that means I now have the capacity to bring on more clients. If, on the other hand, I say, no, we're in depth, we're comprehensive. Our real estate investors have a lot of moving parts, so it might be 15 hours of time. But then this other guardrail that I have in my business is at a 55% EBOC or a 60% EBOC, I want to make $500,000. All right, that means that my business needs to do $875,000 in revenue. I have this do the math and understand the guardrails on that and know which one of those levers you have to pull. If it comes down to me saying, all right, I'm not willing to negotiate on these two variables, which is hours per client and day and hours that I want to work, hours total invested in the year, the last variable that I have to influence then is my revenue per client. That's where you attend our raising fee session tomorrow, when we can talk about what your fee schedule needs to be. Do that math when it comes to your niche, because the worst thing that can happen is for an advisor to go through this whole exercise. I had an advisor when I was wet behind the ears, didn't know up from down, left from right, and he was in my same boat, and he wanted to work with musicians. Exactly. And again, I think I was in business for 24 months at this time. Even I laughed. And our managing principal at the time, he's like, they gotta have money to work with you. But it's his passion, right? Do the math, because the worst thing that can happen is you do everything that we're talking about here of promoting and positioning yourself and marketing, and then, right, one of the pivotal or keystone business phrases that everybody should internalize, you can't make up profit and volume. Know your numbers.
Yeah, and also on that, know your niche. I keep not putting it close enough, sorry. How many of you have filled out one of these forms that we have on our in the library, who's done not only looked at your niche from a demographic standpoint, but also from a psychographic standpoint. Okay, we got some A-plus people in the back. The rest of y'all will check in at your next coaching session. But also, you know, looking at your ideal target client from, again, the demographic, like I bet a lot of y'all can say, you know, they're this age range, they've done this profession, but, you know, also looking at them from what are their values, what are their interests, maybe they love to travel, maybe they love wine. I know a few of you do the passion prospecting, or you have, you know, you work with retirees who like to travel in RVs. I don't know. I just made that up.
You said doo-doo.
Did I say doo-doo? I'm sorry.
I had to point it out. I'm sorry. I can't do a presentation. I hear someone say that. It just, you said doo-doo.
Is doo-doo a common presentation?
No, I don't know. I just, it always catches in my mind when I hear someone say that. Sorry, I didn't mean to blow
up
your train
of
thought.
Sorry about that, y'all.
What in all seriousness, the point that I wanted to make on top of that is this is a moving target, right? Going back, if I were to look at my niche back in 2019 when I first had this epiphany that I don't have to work with optometrists, dentists, pharmacists, and physicians, right? 2020 money used to be called the dose because I thought that I would create this podcast that was going to be for white coat professionals. And then I realized as soon as I did one episode on how restricted stock units work with the CVS compensation plan, every dentist, optometrist, and physician that was listening, skip. And the alliterative phrase in any type of content creation that you're doing in content creation, consistency is key. And so the first revision was, all right, get rid of the dentists, pharmacists, and physicians and work with optometrists. Did that for a while. And then I started to realize a pattern and see a trend in that I enjoyed and the problems were much more planning focused on practice owners. So then it became, I like working with optometrists that are practice owners, optometric private practice owners. And then I started really falling in love with valuations and statements of financial, a statement of financial value, the transition, the emotional concept, the grieving process that every business owner goes through when they sell their business, stewarding them, the LOIs and PAs for private equity. So it's like, all right, I really enjoy helping practice owners that are getting to the point of having a liquidity event, the financial planning, the pension plans, the cash balance plans, accelerating, like all of that technical stuff married in, like, be observant as you're going through this niche. And that's another hang up that we'll see advisors get is if they make the decision of going for their niche, that's one thing. But then they feel like, oh, I can't change this. I can't adjust this going forward. Yes, you can. Because guess what? The vast majority of the public doesn't care. They don't know who you are. And your niche isn't going to matter either, right? Just because I subtly started on the podcast saying, on 2020 Money, we help optometric private practice owners proactively manage cash flow, reduce taxes, and invest prudently. I still have associates come up to me or non-practice owners at conferences say how much they enjoy the podcast. So you're not alienating a part of your niche just because you narrow that down. You're just making it that much easier for you to attract your ideal client going forward. So it can be a moving target. So my point in all of this, you can tell brevity is not one of my high qualities or values. Write it in pencil or keep that sheet handy and be observant as you're having these conversations and making progress on your marketing efforts.
Yeah, not to call out Jennifer or Chris back there. I think y'all were the ones who raised your hands. I'd love to know, like, what are some of the interests, values, or, you know, that you've identified of your target clients? Valuing the advice. And how do you, I get this question a lot, like how do you weed out the people who don't value your advice? Thank you, Chris.
So through the prospecting process was the answer. Just asking good questions. Yeah. Jennifer, are you going to say something? So for virtual people, I'll synthesize that in the way, I'll synthesize it this way. If you can get to the point of answering questions that they didn't know that they should be asking themselves, or counseling them on problems that they didn't yet observe, that is one of the fastest way to accelerate the trust equity that you have in the relationship and demonstrate that you know something that 99% of advisors out there don't. One of the phrases that we say early on in the client, if a prospect is even remotely vacillating on like kicking the tires, do I need to work with you? Should I work with you? What makes you different? I say, what other advisors think of as world-class financial planning is bare bones table stakes for us. The difference between our firm and any other advisory firm out there is because we know the business of optometry so well, we know what strategies and questions to ask that neither you nor your existing advisor even thought of. So our goal is to look through the windshield instead of the rearview mirror and answer their questions the right way the first time. Is that something, and then if I'm like feeling snarky, I'm like, is that something you might be interested in?
Yeah, I mean, I think on that note, you know, if all of y'all in this room more or less do the same thing, right? So it's like, how do you make yourself stand out and, you know, unique to your target client?
Oh, the get to work part, right? And again, we're bouncing around a little bit here just in conversations and in interaction. Again, just as a reminder, if you do have questions, we're going to have some Q&A time at the end, so make sure you write those down and we'll... Allison, do we have a mic, a third mic that we'll be able to run? Perfect. Okay. So virtual people, we got you. We're not forgetting about you. We'll make sure that we get those questions in there. We've talked about, again, I've hit on these a little bit, the blue ocean concept, right? Remember that I saying no to Seth Godin talks about in The Practice, one of his, I think it is his latest book, that being able to appeal to only 1% is more than enough for any type of service-based business. So be comfortable with that and embrace the blue ocean mentality. That was one of the reasons, candidly, I went to optometry over dentistry, because there's a lot of it. Any advisors here work with dentists as a niche? No. Okay. There's a lot out there.
They're all going to go change their niche now.
In all seriousness, I am kind of surprised that with as much pontificating as I have done in the advisory space about how beneficial optometry has been, I've only had one other advisor that I'm aware of that has actually started to build a brand around optometry nationwide. I think he's in out west, California, somewhere along those lines. I'm honestly kind of surprised, and I really don't care if everybody in here decided to switch to optometry, because there's 34,000 optometrists nationwide, roughly 11,000 private practices. I'm on a goal for 250. I think there's enough for us to all play nicely together. So, right, the idea of a blue ocean, share your niche, existing clients and COIs. If I had to be critical of myself, this was the one mistake that I made with my existing clients in not letting them know and keeping them abreast of what I was doing. I lost one client because of it, because I didn't proactively let them know the direction that I was taking the firm. At the end of the day, once I got the notice that the client was leaving via the ACAT out, it's always warm and fuzzy, isn't it? Yeah. So much emotion attached to that TD Ameritrade alert. Outgoing transfer. Oh, what? That shot across the bow, though, I went back and I had conversations with clients. And the resounding theme that I heard was, we're so happy for you. That's awesome. That sounds exciting. Just don't forget about us. One of our clients said, you may have 100 of us, but we only have one of you. And that, now, interestingly enough, we ended up parting ways down the road amicably. They're family friends of ours. They're still family friends, but... There was more than one of us, yes. I found another one of me, yes. They changed. Well, not to digress too far down that path, but depending on the role that you're looking to serve in your firm, one of the very celebratory but also sad days for me was when I realized that I'm not that big of a deal. And transitioning clients to John, the lead advisor in our firm now, that was part of the niche transition and knowing my economic impact in the firm, was actually getting fired, proverbially speaking, from one of our existing relationships. Showed up in a client meeting with John thinking that, oh, I'm transitioning to John, and 10 minutes in, the client's like, why are you here? I said, I just wanted to see how things are going. He's like, John's been taking great care of us. You can go. You don't need to be here. I'm like, aw. I was so sad and so proud at the same time. So, but communicate to your clients proactively, your existing clients, what the plan is going to be. I think we've got a slide coming up here. Right, if you're going to burn the ships, which Don, I think Don did more than I did, where he basically, I don't know if he sold his book or if he just basically found another home for advisors. But
I don't think my mic is working, but thanks. Do you have a, because I get asked a lot, like, should I sell my book? How should I get rid of my ideal clients that I have? Do you have any advice or thoughts there?
So I wrestled with this for a while when we were making this pivot, and in one of our planning sessions, Kathy, so like, it's one of those Captain Obvious statements now that I think of that I couldn't believe, because I was this, well, I only want to work with practice owners. I only want them to be a client if they have a practice, and I want to help them sell their practice. She's like, so what do you call an optometrist the day after they sell their practice? Every one of your ideal clients, like everybody that works with retirees is that ideal client. She's like, so why can't we just reduce the service model to what we would provide to retirees and still do all the cool things that you're doing for your practice owners? I'm like, that's a pretty damn good idea. I think we'll do that. And so that's where this whole wedding cake analogy kind of came in. So I think the biggest decision that you have to make, not to make it all about the numbers, but to go left brain on everybody here, closer. Really? Okay. That sounds so weird. Totally lost my train. Yeah, I know. Well, like my voice, like it gets so low. Like focus. Okay, my left brain, go to the math. It's easy to go through your client roster. One of the hardest decisions is to go through your client roster and say, which ones am I going to keep? Which ones am I not going to keep? If you really want a challenging exercise on that, have your office manager, and I really suggest having someone else do this. Hopefully all of you have an ability to pull 12 trailing 12 revenue per household. Pull that list, hide column A or whatever column has their name in it. Go back to your profitability analysis, right? A times B times C equals top line revenue targeting a certain EBOX, so you have pre-tax take home out of the business. If we're answering this truly from a business point of view, everybody below that line, ship it. Now you're having the question of, do I sell it or do I do I transition it to another? One of the worst decisions that advisors can make in that situation, oh, I'm going to hire a junior advisor to serve my lower revenue clients. Awesome. So what's your all right, I don't know what's happening with mics here, but we're okay. So awesome. What you're telling me is that you're going to add more weight to your P&L on the expense side of to serve someone that wasn't already profitable with just you, and now you're going to add an $85,000 to $90,000 expense to serve someone that already wasn't unprofitable. Worst decision you could make. Now, if part of that process is to hire a service advisor while raising fees to make that person profitable with the service advisor already in your P&L, now you have my attention and we can have a conversation about that. But that's like if you're going to do, if you have door A, B, and C, that hiring that service advisor being that's the worst decision that you can make. Nothing will guarantee you to lose money faster than to hire a service advisor to serve already unprofitable clients. Put a quarter in me on that one. So, go back to that. That's how I'd answer that. We lost a mic, and this one is pretty much getting towards the end of the content here. Yeah. I do want to emphasize again back to the existing clients. I'm trying to think of another advisor that I know that has truly burned the ships to sell off their clients. What I really want to challenge you on doing is, and we'll get into this as we go through Limitless talking about the service model, is determining how you can layer those different avatars, those different client service needs, and the experience that you want to provide to your client. How can you do that for the people that are outside of your niche? And where do you draw the line on saying, for example, the teacher in my previous hypothetical, like that should be someone that would be transitioned out. If you can go through your existing client base and realize that, you know, we had physicians. I had a couple of physician clients that didn't fit. They were a profitable client, but from a pure service model standpoint, the more I learned about how much more I knew about optometry and the mistakes, it wasn't the mistakes, it was the missed opportunities. We started seeing clients that were coming on board that were working with an advisor that by all accounts were doing phenomenal financial planning, right? Good financial plans, investment portfolios would pass most of our standard of care, if you will, let's put it this way. We weren't seeing a bunch of portfolios loaded up in C shares with an advisory fee on top of it, right? They were good financial plans, but that advisor was a generalist. And so we came in, and as we got into the numbers of the practice, we saw one of our best examples. We had a client sitting on $965,000 of cash in their business that had been working with an advisor. Like, that's the irony of the whole situation. But because that advisor didn't have a way to talk to them about their business and, quote unquote, all they had been doing was the basic financial planning, that prospect came to us and said, hey, we got an advisor. We feel good on the personal side. What should we do on the business side? It's like, I have some ideas on what we can do with 965 grand. The mark of a great niche advisor, here's something else that I internalized a long time ago as well. A long time ago, like 3 years ago. The mark of a niche advisor is that you know just a little bit more than every other advisor out there, but it's that little bit that makes all the difference in the world to your ideal client. There's nothing magical. Like, it's not like I have this laundry list of expertise in the field of optometry. But it's the handful of nuggets that make all the difference to them and separate me from everybody else out there. So bringing this back to with your existing clients, if you find yourself with my physicians, I realized I know their contract has something called RVUs, right? Anybody work with physicians in here? So compensation structure, there's something with RVUs, and you can make a salary, but then your bonus, and like there's real tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars that can be on the table from a contract negotiation with the hospital organization on our, I keep wanting to say RSU, RVU, and RSV. So, letters are, I don't know how to negotiate that. I can do all the basic planning, but they were much better served with Ryan Inman, Physician Wealth Services. So it becomes, when you start thinking of your business through the niche, it becomes so much easier to now think of your existing clients. Is there another niche advisor that would be better off for them? And the weird thing is, they are so appreciative of you for doing that, and you'd actually get referrals from them as well, because now they know who your ideal client is. Someone's got to turn my mic off or I'll just keep going. Let's open it up for questions.
Any questions?
At the beginning of the talk, you had said this is a 3-year runway, give or take, right? A lot of people have done it sooner. Some people it's taken longer. When you go back to that other slide that said burn the ship or transition slowly, so if, I guess my question is, if it truly is a 3-year transition, why would you sell off those non-ideal clients at the very beginning when it takes 2 to 3 years to see that income ramp up? I mean, what if you, do you understand what I'm saying? How do you?
So part of it is the financial aspect of it, part of it is time, and part of it is emotional. So for some advisors, the emotional aspect of starting with a blank slate just gives them the opportunity to, it's an opportunity cost. I don't have to spend time servicing these existing relationships. I can pour all of that energy that I would put into servicing non-ideal clients into the niche marketing of my practice. Amplified, if you actually do sell your practice and get a lump sum for that, that can make up that revenue. The most common approach is doing a transition where for every new client that I bring in, right, for our optometry clients, the first year revenue is $10,280. So for every, in the beginning when I was building that, for every new client that I'd bring on, I'd go to the bottom of my non-ideal area, I'd go to the bottom of my non-ideal client list and then find $10,000 of revenue and transition them out. So that the net revenue, the net impact to me was zero, but I was making significant progress because for every one large, quote unquote, large client that I would be bringing on, right, I was bringing on $1 million, right? If we think of that from an AUM standpoint, I was bringing on $1 million client that made it easier to transition 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 non-ideal clients that candidly shouldn't have been in the business to begin with. So did I do a steady transition to make up for the lost income? It was for me specifically, it was two phases. I had non-ideal, non-profitable clients, a dozen maybe I think it was. That was a rip the Band-Aid off, just ship them to retail, send out a letter, and that was it. Like,
were they clients? Yes, they were. Yes, they were.
Yes, they were clients, but it didn't make sense to keep them. And the second wave of that was, could they be ideal revenue clients? Yes, and it required raising their fee and having that conversation, and then if they didn't agree to the fee raise or they weren't going to be an ideal client, then they would be kind of shipped into that purgatory area where, like, okay, you don't know that you're going to be gone, but you're eventually going to be gone once I bring on more ideal clients. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay.
Okay, Adam, question from online folks. What yes. suggestions do you have when communicating a change in your niche? I told my CPA COIs that my niche is high-performing coaches and consultants with revenue over 500, but I realize that we still do great work with clients for lower revenue.
So I guess that last part is what I'm wondering what the question is. So, like, are they, I know this is hard to ask.
Check.
Yep, this one's go. Nope, in and out. I think camera one, camera two, camera. I guess I'm still thrown by the last part of that, but we still do great work with other people. Like, is that a consolation prize to say, hey, we're really looking to work with these people, but if you still have other people, we'll still work with them? I would, maybe I'm misunderstanding the question. I would take that last, sorry, I'm looking at Allison, look at the camera. I would take that last part off. I would just be crystal clear on with your CPAs, with your attorneys, with your, like, for us, it's brokers, CVAs, certified valuation analysts, CPAs, CVAs, valuations, and attorneys. Those are our COIs in the optometry space. So we communicate to them, this is who we're looking to do our best work with, period, full stop. There's no other communication. And we still work with these other people. So maybe I'm misunderstanding the question, or hopefully that answers it.
Oh, gosh.
Okay, so I think the COI piece is easier than communicating to current clients.
Agreed.
So if you're narrowing down your niche, so for you, like physicians to optometrists, how did you communicate that? Or like white coats to optometrists, how did you communicate? For me, it's business owners to like narrowing that down. To say, hey, I like you, but not enough.
So it's an easy answer for me because I didn't do a good job of communicating with COIs when I was a specific generalist, right? When I was a specific to OD, MD, PharmD, DDS, I didn't have a solid COI strategy. So I don't think it changes though.
What about to your clients, like specifically your clients that you aren't ideal to help narrow down that? Because you said you
from a transition standpoint.
Yeah.
Well, that was more the fee raise conversation because they weren't ideal first because, and again, I don't mean to take the emotion out of what we do for our clients, but at the end of the day, we are all running a business here. So with that caveat disclaimer, I do have that touchy-feely side of me. Like I can think very right brain, but in the context of this conversation, that I was putting that through the filter of you're unprofitable. And so the fee raise conversation was the catalyst to saying essentially step up or step out. And then it was, by the way, we're changing the firm, or it was all kind of bundled into that conversation, into that positioning statement of we do our best work. I've found a passion and a drive for helping optometric private practice owners. I'm a third generation business owner. My wife's an optometrist. I've really just gravitated towards this profession and I'm pouring a lot of my energy into it. So all of our new clients going forward are optometric private practice owners. I've also had to do a survey from a business perspective of where the business is at right now and realize that I have different fee structures for different clients. Going forward, all of our existing clients are going to be on one of two different fee schedules. It's a financial planning fee broken up into 12 monthly payments, so it's an annual fee paid monthly. For someone in your situation, that fee is going to be, at the time it was, gosh, I even grad found there's some clients at $150 a month, $1,800 a year. Most of them were at $275, and now for our non-OD practice owners, it's $395 a month with a $1,500 onboarding fee. So that essential, that was essentially how I would package that conversation to address both of them in the same time. Okay. Do you have one more question? Okay.
Real quick, I'm just starting my marketing journey, so would you recommend trying to figure out how my niche consumes content, or more along the lines of finding something that I enjoy doing and just kind of going with that and then figuring it out along the way?
Yes. See, I like that for an answer, right? Don't force it, and there's a good chance that with I'd be hard-pressed to say that you're not going to find kind of a Venn diagram, like that middle section of where your people are hanging out and a modality of communication that you're good at. Whether it's podcasting, video, writing, speaking, any one of those mediums, a subset of your niche is going to be consuming, and then it's a matter of cross-pollinating from there, right? So the podcast is a middle of funnel, dare I say top of funnel. Now we're working on Facebook ads and LinkedIn to drive people towards the podcast. I don't have to do that. I stay in my lane of podcast production, but I can hire people to cross-promote and cross-pollinate. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Oh, we're good?
Yeah, we're good.
Thank you for being here, for the questions.